afternoon, everybody. Welcome to this afternoon's special plenary session and speaker. I'm Dave Hogg, current president, if you don't know who I am by now, soon to be past president. So it's with great pleasure that I introduce today's speaker, Dr. James McWilliams, who's an associate professor of history at Texas State University at San Marcos, and a fellow in the Agrarian Studies program at Yale. Dr. McWilliams specializes in colonial and early American history and environmental history of the U.S. He received a BA from Georgetown, MA from Harvard, and PhD from Johns Hopkins. Dr. McWilliams has written articles for the New York Times, the LA Times, and the Washington Post, among other publications, and was a winner of the 2001 Whitehall Prize in Colonial History. He's also the author, and this is how I came to know of Dr. McWilliams. He published a book called American Pests, The Losing War on Insects from Colonial Times to DDT, which I found to be very engaging, and that's how I came to invite him to speak to us today. So Dr. McWilliams will share with us his insights on the history of insect control in early America. Dr. McWilliams, please join me in welcoming. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave, and thank you to the Entomological Society. This is great. I don't think I've ever regretted not bringing my sunglasses to an academic talk. I'm going to talk today about the importance of communication between experts and non-experts. And I think as a historian, this is perfectly appropriate. I walked around the exhibits today and it hit me, as it often always does when I dip into your field, that I am remarkably ignorant about what's going on. So I'm coming at this from a very different perspective. I hope it's of some use. In 1794, the Massachusetts Historical Society for the Promotion of Agriculture decided to offer a $50 reward to any farmer who could find a solution to a recent outbreak of cankerworms. The inchworms were wreaking havoc on the region's extensive apple orchards, and the members of the society were at pains to advise farmers about what to do. It was pretty clear, though, that something had to be done. As the noted agricultural writer Samuel Dean wrote that same year, "Cankerworms have become so voracious that in a few weeks they reach all the leaves of a tree, preventing its bearing for that year and the next, and give it the appearance of a burnt tree. We'll lose all our apples if this continues." It might seem strange, at least from our contemporary perspective, that an agricultural society would turn to average, everyday yeoman farmers for help in solving an entomological problem that today would be handled by credentialed authorities endowed with considerable expertise, not to mention access to an impressive toolbox of chemical and biological and genetic weaponry. But in 1794, there were no noted authorities on insect infestation. Weapons were weak, often little more than one's own fingers. Every farmer was his own entomologist. Every farmer managed insects in his own unique way. And fortunately, the responses to the Massachusetts Society's call for solutions reveals that they were eager, very eager to share their ideas. One farmer observed that the apple trees near where his sheep grazed were free of the worm, so he instructed farmers to lay sheepskins under their trees. Another noted that in his wife's kitchen garden, cankerworms were also found devouring mustard greens. So he suggested that orchard keepers plant mustard greens around their trees to attract the cankerworms away from the apple trees. A third noticed that the worms proceeded to attack the tree from the bottom to the top and argued that farmers should coat the bottom of the trees with a thick layer of tar to keep the cankerworms from getting to the fruit. A farmer from Lynn, Massachusetts, observed that the plot of land where he happened to dump the water in which he brined his hams was often strewn with dead insects. So he swore by the application of this herbal brine to the base of the trees and offered it for sale. Another suggested a smudge of cow dung, and yet another proposed filling every bark crevice with clay. And of course, inevitably, one farmer found some success in the application of his own urine. There was, it seemed, always somebody ready to sing the praises of his own urine, or at least that of his farm animals. There's a thick file at the Massachusetts Historical Society in Boston containing descriptions of these elixirs and concoctions. I find them to be completely fascinating documents. The letters are written on old scraps of worn paper in faint black ink or lead pencil. The scrawl is usually scratchy, and the letters are often of borderline literacy. But ultimately, I'm really struck by their homegrown, ad hoc, and often wildly speculative nature. The winning answer actually doesn't survive, but so what? As I see it, what's significant here is the fact that entomological information in pre-industrial North America was radically decentralized. It was localized, and it was directed by men and women who, although they lacked any sort of formal training, proposed solutions to insect problems that were always provisional, never authoritative, and every now and then pretty effective. Most historians haven't seen it this way. There's been a tendency to dismiss this early era of entomological investigation as either insignificant or as a disorganized scramble of random information unworthy of historical analysis. One has gone so far as to sneer at this vernacular quest to minimize insect infestation as little more than a chaos of experimentation. But to me, this chaos is a beautiful chaos. In fact, it's one that I decided to spend several years investigating, and one that, as I will try to explain in this brief talk, became the basis for a national approach to insect control that, by the middle of the 19th century, was pragmatic, flexible, open-minded, and free of polarizing controversies. My thesis, which is entirely drawn from past events, is this. When the attempt to manage insects in agriculture begins with and always includes the input of those closest to the ground, namely the farmers, what you get, or seem to get, is an approach to insect control that is inclusive, suspicious of dogmatism, realistic in its goals, and ultimately based on humility, rather than the idea that farmers can either work within the rhythms of nature or conquer those rhythms to grow our food. What you get, in other words, is a kind of early form of integrated pest management. The farmer-inspired solutions that came in response to the cankerworm in Massachusetts were actually quite typical of early 19th century insect control efforts in general. Relying on their untutored ingenuity, farmers undertook extensive trial and error experiments to figure out what insects attacked what plants, what insects attacked what insects, what birds ate what insects, what birds drove off what birds, and what weeds lured insects away from cash crops. In a sense, they turned their farms into agrarian laboratories. And their solutions were as varied as their observations. Some of my favorite include the following. One farmer in Maine lined his vegetable garden with hollowed out lobster claws lined with honey to lure away ants. He would periodically just empty them somewhere else. Another inserted, and I don't know how anybody comes up with this, but another inserted the clefts of green elder stems into small cabbages to keep away garden fleas. And a third applied to his plants a concoction of cow dung, human urine, and soap. And it's easy to laugh a little at these approaches, but in a day and age before synthetic insecticides and entomological authority, this was it. You know, this was pest management. Farmers were the sole creators of entomological knowledge. I doubt many of their tactics actually worked, but the benefits that emerged from this exciting chaos of experimentation went far beyond the solutions themselves. When farmers pioneered their own answers to insect problems, they developed in the process several basic social and intellectual habits that would prove crucial to the evolution of a national approach to insect management. And three of these habits stand out, so I want to go through them one by one. First, early American farmers were masterful when it came to communication. They pretty much had to be. Their primary method of spreading information was, not surprisingly, the agricultural newspaper. In these very localized publications, farmers published their own solutions and pest control hypotheses in a collaborative quest to try to find patterns in the chaos of experimentation. Often messages could be as short as 20 or 30 words, sort of like pre-industrial tweets. At other times, they could become treatise-like, spanning several dense columns. The spirit of this communication was humble and curious. Farmers wrote to each other through the paper in order to learn who was trying what was working, what was a complete waste of time. They did not in any sense aim to become formal authorities. They were not proprietary about what they found. Instead, they published under the assumption that every possible remedy was far-flung, most likely temporary, and perhaps only useful to a single place at a single time. When Samuel Deane, who was the writer I quoted earlier, published a lengthy and quite detailed description of how to control for the tobacco worm, he ended his treatise by saying, "I dare not positively assert its efficacy." And this humility typified the tone and tenor of a farmer's detailed notes from the ground. A second quality that early American farmers cultivated in their investigations was an intense belief in the singular power of empirical observation. I realize this point might be too obvious, but it's also, I think, too crucial to pass over. Farmers were ecologists. They understood the complexity of the natural world because they spent their lives negotiating that complexity. They rooted their approaches to insect control not in theories, not in abstractions about the natural world, but in their daily witness to its inner workings. When farmers found plants that could be ground up and dusted on cash crops, or when they pressed certain weeds to extract a possible liquid insecticide, or when they puffed sulfur vapor upwards into a tree full of caterpillars and counted them as they dropped, they confirmed more than a desperate need to reduce insect infestations. They confirmed an in-depth, if untutored, insight into nature's secrets. Again, all this might seem very obvious, but when you consider that entomologists schooled in the late 19th century and beyond often had no grounding whatsoever in the natural world, which is to say they spent most of their lives looking down the barrel of a microscope, the ecological rootedness of early American farmers takes on a bit more significance. Third, farmers practiced a radical pragmatism when it came to methods of insect control. In many ways, this was kind of a pre-political Eden. It was an age when farmers valued a diversification of methods rather than a singular line of attack. Again, in contrast with the future culture wars that would rage over insecticides and agriculture in general, the early American period, at least before 1880, was marked by an effort to integrate cultural, biological, and chemical techniques. On any given commercial farm in 1850, a farmer could be found dusting with pyrethrums, encouraging or introducing beneficial insects or birds, and adjusting planting schedules or diversifying crop selection to minimize invasion. No methods were considered mutually exclusive. There were no official standards designating one sort of farm versus another based on how insects were managed. Even as commercial farms expanded and became more monocultural later in the century, farmers continued to pursue an integrated approach reflective of mixed farming that prevailed in the 17th and 18th centuries. Part of their flexibility, I think, had to do with the fact that farmers, really before 1850, never entertained the idea that insects could be eradicated. Managed, yes, but never exterminated. Extermination, at least as it was applied to insects, was still very much a distant dream. So more than any others, these three qualities, the ability to communicate and share information in a collaborative spirit, the intimate grounding that farmers had in the natural world, and a refusal to polarize methods into value-laden categories, these qualities established the basis for a national approach to insect control that by 1850 had achieved moderate success in managing insect infestations. Historians are generally quite wary when people talk about a golden age. We're generally not big on telling happy stories. But this was a time that I have to admit was marked by a tremendous degree of balance, common sense, and pragmatism. And with the advent of the first economic entomologists, the professionals, the positive qualities I've just gone over only intensified. If the common narratives in American history are to be trusted, the advent of the first economic entomologists in the mid-19th century should have spelled the decline of the vernacular knowledge that I've just talked about. Farmers, in other words, should have been marginalized. Indeed, when it comes to the interaction of professional expertise and vernacular knowledge in general, the conventional narrative usually has the rise of the professionals leading to the demise of the non-professionals. But remarkably, this did not happen with the emerging field of economic entomology. And the reason it did not is somewhat fortuitous. Historians are also never much inclined to attribute historical change to the direct result of a few men. But in this story, this seems to be the case. The first entomologists were brilliant, sensitive, tactful founding fathers who were smart enough to realize that their success depended on explicitly integrating their own expertise with that of the farmers they were committed to helping. I want to say a few words on four of these early pioneers. The first was Thaddeus William Harris. Harris was a medical doctor who quit practicing in the 1830s to dedicate his life to the study of insects that harmed crops. His parents were not pleased. But since a young boy, he'd been enthralled by insects, spending hours and hours in the woods behind his parents' home in Massachusetts looking for the next specimen. Even though he had to take a job as a librarian at Harvard to make ends meet as an economic entomologist, he changed the nature of entomology when he published in 1841 a book called A Report on the Insects of Massachusetts Injurious to Vegetation. The solutions offered in this book were authoritative, based on careful life cycle analyses, and most importantly, accessible to any literate farmer. Harris wrote in the introduction of his book that it was specifically for, quote, persons whose honorable employment is the cultivation of the soil. When Harris died, somewhat tragically, he considered his work an utter failure. But 40 years after his death, one entomologist at an annual meeting noticed that Harris, quote, ran the first furrow in economic entomology, and the rest of us have followed. Many of Harris's most affecting letters, by the way, can be found in the Asa Gray Library at Harvard. A second pioneer was Asa Fitch. Fitch, whose letters and really quite detailed diary I spent time with at the Sterling Library at Yale, is in many ways an incredibly appealing character. Fitch also abandoned a medical career, dropping out of medical school in New York to move upstate, build what his bemused neighbors called his bug house, and obsessively hunt down and study the insects that were ravaging New York farms. Fitch published 14 pivotal reports between 1855 and 1872 while working as a state entomologist of New York. And all of these reports were geared towards helping farmers deal with immediate, everyday, practical problems. His prose was clear, sparse and precise. In order to reach farmers with, you know, quite complex life cycle information, he wrote, as he put it, quote, in a plain, familiar manner, accessibility. His work absolutely consumed him. I am, he explained in one letter to a friend, quite indifferent whether I sleep or remain awake, but I prefer the latter. His diary confirms this commitment to consciousness, as he usually slept no more than 3 hours a night. A third figure is Charles Riley, Charles Valentine Riley. Riley became the first federal entomologist. Having grown up in part on an Illinois farm, his earliest entomological concerns initially centered on the infestations suffered by Midwestern farmers. Riley spent his youth keeping bees and sketching insects, the latter which he was able to do with both hands at once. He began writing for the Prairie Farmer at the age of 22, and by his late 20s was a state entomologist of Missouri, where he wrote a series of four path-breaking reports, most of them having to do with the Rocky Mountain locust. Riley taught classes at the University of Missouri, wowing students, as you can imagine, with his ambidextrous sketching abilities. He maintained a special interest in biological control, and as head of the Division of Entomology, pushed very hard for more research into biological measures. He died tragically in a biking accident in his late 50s. He was riding to the Natural History Museum in Washington, D.C. to examine a new shipment of insect specimens when his bike hit a paving stone, catapulting him over the handlebars. A final leading light of the era was Benjamin Dan Walsh. Walsh, who founded the Practical Entomologist in 1865, based his entire career, a quite passionate career, on as an economic entomologist, on a point he made in the second issue of this publication. "It is a remarkable fact," he wrote, "that fully half of our insect foes are not Native American citizens, but have been introduced here from Europe." This assessment not only predisposed Walsh to join Riley in pursuing biological methods, but it reflected his deep, really quite angry distrust of the chemical remedies that unscrupulous companies were hawking to farmers looking for a quick cure. He called these concoctions hell broths, made of a hodgepodge of ingredients, such as enters the witch's cauldron in Macbeth. He had rhetorical flair, for sure. Walsh also died tragically and prematurely, getting run over by a train as he read his mail, an accident that I can't seem to fully understand, but evidently happened. Riley once said of Walsh, "Everything about Benjamin Walsh was Walshian." Unlikely tragedies notwithstanding, these men, and certainly many, many others like them, established a model of insect control that combined formal expertise and inexpert knowledge of insects and their place in the natural world. Their triumph, and it truly was a triumph, was in establishing a system of national insect control that managed insect infestations without succumbing to a polarizing debate over which one-size-fits-all solution should be employed over and above the others. I'd like to mention just a few quick aspects of their work in general that enabled these men to build a national program of insect control that we can look back on with a certain amount of admiration and perhaps envy. First, economic entomologists working in the 19th century viewed their mission in terms of bringing to farmers a well-defined body of scientific knowledge, all of it having to do with life cycles of destructive insects. This was information that no farmer could fully obtain on his own, but it was also information that, if he had it, could illuminate matters tremendously. Most critically, it could allow the farmer to properly time his method of management. This is what the economic entomologist ultimately brought to the farmer. Not the solution or the method, but a very real sense of when to apply that solution or method. As Asa Fitch put it, quote, "Our job is to study the life cycles of those insects which are injurious so that those who suffer from these pests can devise the most suitable and effectual modes for combating them." So agency still remained with the farmer. Second, as this first quality suggests, the original economic entomologists were respectful and even quite admiring of the farmer's homegrown knowledge. They continually visited farms and solicited the farmers' empirical observations regarding insect behavior. They showed up on the farm not with answers, but with questions. Again, it was Benjamin Walsh who I think put it best when he wrote, "I am perpetually meeting with farmers who know a great deal more about the natural history of insects than I do." This humility was fostered by the fact that most early economic entomologists had some experience, if not extended experience, working on a farm. More importantly, this quality endeared the entomologists to the farmers they very much wanted to help. It was quite common at the time, particularly in the South, for farmers to distrust the advice, much less the motives of book learning, of university or government scientists. But the early economic entomologists effectively overcame this distrust. Finally, despite the preference that men such as Riley and Walsh had for the methods of biological control, they remained as open as farmers to applying whatever combination of cultural, chemical, and biological techniques promised to be the most cost-effective and useful. Division of entomology entomologists, in addition to state entomologists, experiment station employees, and entomologists employed at land-grant schools, took the farmers' historical willingness to experiment with a wide range of combinations and solutions and systematically recorded them in federal publications. Walsh may have published screeds against a wide variety of chemical concoctions, but he and others were more than willing to give the earliest manufactured insecticides, namely Paris Green and London Purple, a fair chance to prove their worth. As with the farmers, the entomologists avoided dogmatism when it came to fighting insects. As with the farmers, they were willing to tolerate a little chaotic experimentation. It's for these reasons, I think, that the earliest economic entomologists successfully worked with farmers to manage insect infestations through what we would today recognize as a rudimentary form of integrated pest management. But of course, we all know that this system didn't last. It crumbled under the weight of a very different kind of commercial agriculture, one that throughout the last 100 years or so has been empowered by insecticides unprecedented in their power, synthetic fertilizer, federal support of extensive monocultural production, a couple of world wars, and the emergence of global demand for American food. The result of this highly commercialized system of agriculture was, in a sense, an almost miraculous accomplishment. Yields per acre exploded, exports soared, farmer wealth increased, mass starvation was avoided, Malthus over and over again was kicked to the curb. But building a national breadbasket, of course, came with costs. The Dust Bowl, chemical runoff and residue, human health and toxicity concerns, food with less and less nutrition, a growing dependency of farmers on chemical and seed companies, the Twinkie. National awareness of these programs reached a fevered pitch in 1960 of these problems. National awareness of these problems reached a fevered pitch in 1962 with Rachel Carson and the debates over agricultural chemicals and, by extension, agricultural practices in general that she inspired. I've closely followed these debates as they have played out to the present day. I am thoroughly, overwhelmingly depressed by them. With the benefit of hindsight, I can say that they are needlessly polarized. In the wake of Carson, whom I write about with measured admiration in my book, the agricultural world divided into good and bad, organic and conventional, free-range and confined, corporate or family, industrial or sustainable, and so on. We seem to have lost the ability, as we debate these issues, to appreciate the inconvenient fact that growing food happens in the gray area between these extremes, and that the solutions we pioneer must recognize, as did those pioneered by our 19th century brethren, that there is no room for polarization. Instead, we must open the doors of discourse a little further and include not just the opinions of chemical companies, food writer gurus, trade organizations, journalists, and television personalities, but the very group that makes all our agricultural discussions possible in the first place, farmers. Thank you.
Thank you. Good job. Thanks very much. Very interesting stuff. If you have questions, we would certainly entertain them.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know we were going to be happy to, yeah.
Any questions or comments? Yeah.
Yeah, you know, how did the attitudes that I was discussing relate to other countries at the time? What I found was that the fact that the United States had access to so much land very much predisposed them to be more experimental in their methods, mainly because when a farmer undertook a certain set of agricultural practices that weren't working, one very common solution throughout American history, all the way through the 19th century, was to move west and find new land and start over again. And of course, this created a whole slew of entomological problems, agricultural problems. But it also meant that you could kind of go back to the drawing board in terms of experimentation. So while I have not systematically looked at what was happening in places like Germany or France, England, Spain at the time, my educated guess here would be that the United States was far more tolerant and flexible in the 19th century and willing to try a wider variety of methods. But your question's a sensitive one because, you know, the one criticism that I've kind of systematically gotten about my book is that I have this sense of American exceptionalism and that that may not be altogether fair, but my sense is that there was something exceptional about what American farmers were dealing with. Yes? Okay, what was the role of the county extension agents? Because you lived in Chile for a year, and the only people who would tell you what was infesting your crops were chemists. Yeah, and chemical companies. Well, in the 19th, of course, the role of the extension agent changes dramatically with the rise of the development of commercial agriculture in the 20th century. But what I found is when they began to work in the 19th century, they were very much integrated into the system that these first economic entomologists pioneered, which was go out to the farms, visit the farms, and systematically collect information. This actually, and then let's bring it back and analyze it and see what it means. And this habit of just direct empirical quantitative work continued well into the 1920s with the extension agents. And I spent a lot of time looking at these insect surveys where every county in every state filed, you know, their report, and down to the number of, you know, potato beetles that were discovered on somebody's farm. So I think, you know, with the rise of the chemical companies, obviously their role did change, and in many cases a lot of extension agents get their information from, I imagine, chemical companies. But at the time period that I looked at, I didn't really find that that was the case. Okay, so I'm being asked to do a 180 and predict the future of farming. Well, I will say that the challenges that we're facing today are as dire, if not more, than I think farmers have ever faced, given that globally, the population's going to reach 9 billion by 2050, some say even higher, and development experts predict we need to increase food production by 70%. What does this mean in terms of agriculture in general? I guess I could probably sit here and go ramble on and on about this, but it essentially comes down to density of production. I think we have to employ methods that allow us to produce more calories on less land with as few inputs as we can possibly get away with. And this is going to mean embracing all manner of technology, biotechnology, et cetera. So my answer to the question is to lean, this is, of course, points to some of the polarizing debates that I hinted at in my paper. I find myself today going head to head with a lot of agroecologists whose work I often deeply admire. But at the same time, I feel like there's something quite risky about drawing on pre-industrial agricultural methods at a time when we're under the burden of almost doubling food production in the next 40 years and there's very little arable land left. So I very much lean towards a cautious embrace of technology and biotechnology. All right, well, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.